When you talk about coal, when you hear Joe and Harry Caudle, this broad form deed thing, you know, just, it was outrageous. Surface owner, it wasn't that way in West Virginia. You couldn't, in West Virginia, I think they at least respected landowner could stop a strip mine if he didn't want him to land. They had to get the permission of the landowner in West Virginia, in almost every state, except Kentucky, where the courts had ruled that the mineral estate was paramount. And so even though these folks signed these deeds back in 1890 and 1900, that when the only known method of mining was deep mining, that you had to, the landowner had no rights. If they wanted to strip mine your property, they could come right over you without getting your permission. Because these deeds, that's why they call these old mineral deeds the broad form deeds. They were so broad that they gave the mineral owner the right to do almost anything they wanted to with the property, and you couldn't do anything about it. So we spent about the next 25 years trying to change that. Eventually had to draft a constitutional amendment. I mean, that the litigation story take up, and the cases would take quite some time, but we started filing these cases, and basically, because nobody else would do it anymore, JT, and we filed a number of lawsuits to try to change this interpretation of that. And we started representing people who, in cases where coal companies were trying to get a permit, they had to get a permit. So when they applied to the state for a permit, that gave you a chance to represent the landowner, to get in there and argue for the landowner. At least that was a... And a lot of times, once you did that, sometimes they'd say, well, we'll go over to the next holler where there's nobody else. Because if you opposed them, there were sometimes you could either negotiate or they might even stop. So when, in some of these cases, and so that was very important. I mean, when I've, and I represent, you know, remember Edith Easterling? Remember Edith and Suella?
Tell us about who they were.
Edith was over in Pike County, a little holler called Poor Bottom. She lived on Poor Bottom. And she was became a Vista worker. She was, I would say, you know, she and her husband Jake raised a family. I don't know they ever, but they had a very good social conscience. And I think they realized they just wanted to help their neighbors and were Vista workers and were trying to make life a little better for everybody. And they, I think they gave their, they put up some of the Vista workers at home. And I'm not sure in the very early days whether the, you know, they, where in her early Vista days, it wasn't all coal related. You can tell me what, some of it was welfare, some of it was food stamps, helping people with food stamps and get welfare benefits. People weren't being treated very well by the workers, and it wasn't that easy to get some of these things, so they needed advocates. Some of that happened before I came in 1970. When I met Edith, she called, there was a proposed strip mining operation, which would have gone along the coal seam at their house, above their home on Poor Bottom. It was going to go all the way down Poor Bottom. It was a large coal company had gotten had applied for a permit. They'd actually had started mining at one end. And when Edith called me, So I went over there and met with her and some of the people on the community. Very large, Poor Bottom has a lot of, it's pretty populated holler. In fact, there was a mines, and there was a mining inspector in that community. So we looked at that, and I learned that the actually that that seam had been deep mined. The area above their houses had been deep mined years ago. And turned out, we got a geologist from up at Athens, Ohio. Turned out those workings were full of water. And the company that applied for the strip mine permit did not indicate that there was that prior mining in that area. So we had a hearing in Frankfurt that lasted, I think, several days. We got this expert witness there, and then we got a retired mining inspector, and we proved that those, if they had gone forward with that strip mining and the strip mining had hit the water from those deep mines, that water was going to come down on all these people, and it would be severe, be dangerous. And the cabinet secretary denied the permit, stopped that coal operation. And Suella Kobach, who was Edith's daughter, these people from up, you know, it takes about an hour to get there from here. So for them to get to Frankfurt, about a 3-hour trip back and forth. We went back and forth several times. And we had a hearing officer. I think the hearing officer was going to let them have the permit, and then the secretary overruled them. I'd have to go back and look. But Suella then thought she really was so impressed with what was going on, she ended up going to law school herself. And so Edith, one of the, I found some old clippings. The sidebar to Edith, of course, is that she was, at one point there were Vistas who were living with her or living next door. There was this fellow, Joe Malloy, and who was the other one? It was Tom somebody, and this guy Ratliff, remember the Commonwealth attorney? They went in and they...
Are you talking about Al McShirley?
Al McShirley. And then there was
Tom,
the guy who came after him.
I don't remember Tom.
Yeah, he was, we met him, but they raided their houses, right, and picked up all this literature that they claimed were communist stuff in their houses at home. It wasn't, I don't think it was Edith's house, but eventually McShirley's, the case went to the Supreme Court. If they went to the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they went to the, there was testimony up there because the Commonwealth attorney there in Pike County named Ratliff, he was actually related to Ray Ratliff, who's a lawyer in Charleston with Applered back then, but he was a distant relationship. Well, this fellow Ratliff went in and he seized all this literature, which was progressive stuff and didn't, you know, it was, didn't amount to a hill of beans. But he said it all related to their being communists. And he had them, they indicted them for sedition under the Kentucky Sedition Statute, these workers. And by that time, Bert Combs, who'd been governor of Kentucky, there was a federal court panel, and they declared the Kentucky Sedition Statute unconstitutional. And Dan Jack Combs, who went to the Supreme Court, defended them in that case. And so then I was trying to remember, then I think they eventually filed a damage action in federal court for having to challenge this original arrest and their seizure of this stuff, because they also, the House Un-American Activities Committee had some hearings, and they ended up winning a judgment, McShirley, in Washington, and he used that money to go to law school. He ended up practicing Chapel Hill. And I saw him years later. I didn't know him until we met in North Carolina at a event, because I went to law school there. But, and Edith testified, I think that's how I remember, she testified in that case about that activity. I don't know what, you know. But she was a wonderful woman. And I just read about her a little bit. Sue Ella, there's a historian named Jesse Wilkerson. I don't know if you heard of Jesse. She teaches at the University of Mississippi. And she wrote a dissertation about Southern activist women. And one of them she writes about is Edith and Sue Ella. And she writes about Eula Hall here. And she sent me her draft, and she came up here for our reunion last year. And she wants to write something about Applered. I told her you were here today. I said, I bet she probably knows about you, just either as a musician and your history. She said, so what happened, her dissertation won an award, a prize, and so she used the money or somehow the award. She's in Harvard for a year to turn that dissertation into a book. And so that's what she's doing. But she had written about Edith. But it was a good experience. It was a wonderful group of people. It took us about 6 months, but I represented them. And I think it was an example of other cases where if you represent a community, where if you're challenging a strip mine permit, you can often find something that was wrong way back then in the 70s about what was wrong with that particular application, and you could make it more difficult, more harder for that. We had several of those cases. One of the first cases that we filed, there was a statute in Kentucky that said you can't repeat it, that the cabinet should not issue additional permits to repeated violators of the Strip Mine Act. That was a Kentucky statute. So back in 1971, a long time ago, we went and looked, and we found 30 coal companies who had repeated violations. We went through and many of these companies had violations and there's no evidence, and they didn't pay any attention to this statute. So we filed a petition in the cabinet and said, we want you to stop all these operations because they're repeated violators.
This was in the state cabinet?
Yeah. This is the state cabinet, natural resources. We said, we're going to sue, you need to, well, we went to court to order the cabinet to stop these operations because they weren't supposed, we said you had no right to give them a permit because they were all repeated violators. Well, unfortunately, we didn't win. We lost on a procedure. The court said the way that the court interpreted the statute was that we had to go to every individual county and challenge each of those operations, each of those permits in the county where they were going to do their operation, where they were mining. And so instead of going to we went to Frankfurt because we wanted to file one petition and get that. Now, we didn't appeal that anymore. I think we just didn't have the resources to go to every county. But it was a big signal to the coal companies that we were going to try to keep their feet to the fire as much as we could. That was the first big petition we filed in 71. And then we had a number of these.
So who would you, under this plan, who would you appeal to in the local county?
They said we could file a case saying if the operation was in Floyd County, that court said you could Floyd County Court and say, look, this operation, you can file against the cabinet here. You can't issue a permit to this Triple L Corn Co. because they've got a lot of repeated violations. Go to Breathitt County and say, you can't do this because they've got a repeated violations. One of the things they defended on was said, well, these people have repeated violations, but for these violations, they had to come back and remedy it. You only looked at the traffic ticket. You didn't look at the fact that they paid for it, or you didn't look at the fact that there was a violation.
Did the law say that if they had rectified it, then it was okay?
No. And there was a similar statute, a similar provision in the federal act, which was pretty helpful in some cases. The federal statute in 1977, Federal Strip Mine Act, included something similar to that. But we had several of those cases. I had a guy named, and there were a couple more instances where repeated later on, we had a repeated violator here on Mud Creek, a guy named Sterling Hamilton. I was just looking at those clippings, and we brought up the repeated violation statute, and the cabinet actually would not issue him. They revoked a permit that they had given to him. In that situation. Now, you know, for every permit we stopped, there were probably 20 or 30 that we didn't stop. And all the time this broad form deed thing was going on, year after year after year, I mean, what the companies would end up doing, if they were coming to you, they'd offer you a little bit of money to let them mine. They said, well, we don't have to do this. We're just coming out of the graciousness of our heart. We need to strip mine across your property, and we're going to pay you. We don't have to pay you, but we're going to pay you because we know that's the better thing to do. And for the most of the time, a lot of people would say yes, you know. But some people would say no. And if they said no, they oftentimes would come to us and say they want to come over. And then we'd say, well, we'll look at the permit and let's see what we can do. There weren't any local lawyers who would do that because most lawyers just would charge too much money to do it and didn't think they could get anywhere. Then eventually helped a man write a statute, and we said that as part of the permitting process, you need to get the consent of the landowner. We got the Kentucky legislature passed that statute. That was about 78, 79. The statute said you have to had to get the consent of the landowner. A fellow named Overstreet introduced it for us. Court said that was unconstitutional because it didn't, the Supreme Court, we had an argument. Supreme Court said it's unconstitutional because it doesn't serve an environmental purpose. Said you put it in there as part of the environmental, as a permit application, but my client might say, that's okay with me, you can strip mine if you pay me. John Rosenberg might say no, or vice versa. If you wanted to have a statute that said no strip mining at all, that's one thing. But the fact that it really is up to the individual landowner whether or not to approve doesn't help the environment. So anyway, they said that was unconstitutional.
When lawyers are mounting an argument about the spirit of the law, Is that a fundamental of law, the spirit of a contract? The time that these contracts were entered into, 100 years earlier, people had never seen a bulldozer, had they? Talk about the spirit of the law.
Well,
or
I don't,
contract.
You know, but that actually, there, you're in that situation. You're talking about a legal principle, which we promoted in the next step, and that was that normally in the area of contracts, when you and I contract, we assume the conditions around us. If you don't know that there's such a thing as strip mining, when we contract to let you have the coal, you and I are thinking about deep mining because that's all we know is there. And it's sort of a play on words when we talk about strip mining. So what happened, what we then drafted a statute that said that if the deed itself did not describe the method of mining that was in the contemplation of the parties, it would be presumed, absent some other evidence, that it refers, that it will be the kind of mining which was in existence at the time the deed was executed. So we wrote that statute. And a grocer named Clayton Little over here introduced that statute. And that statute, this was sort of 1981 or two, the court said that statute was unconstitutional in Kentucky because it's up to the court to interpret a deed, not the legislature. The legislature can't tell us how to interpret the deed. It was a 4-3 decision. It was 3-4. It was very close, Akers versus Baldwin.
What was it called?
It was a court case called Akers versus Baldwin. Akers was a fellow named Akers, his first name. He was here from Floyd County. Very strong in Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. He had a radio station here.
A-K-E-R-S?
A-K-E-R-S. Everett Akers. Everett was a very outspoken person, and he had a radio station up here. And at one point, there was a strip mine up there, and they knocked his tower down. And he sued him over that. I can't remember. Somehow, and I think they took out a warrant against him. Well, he was furious from then on, became very strong advocate against strip mining. He was a veteran. His son, he was a really lovely man. His son came to work for me. His son was, whoever, was in his 70s, and his son retired. His son's name was Akers, what was his first name?
It'll come to you.
Yeah, his son came to work here and helped me in a program for the elderly, helped me start a low-income housing program here for this area. He was going to senior citizen centers out in the county. He was from Florida. He had just retired from another position, came back to Floyd County, be near his dad, I think. Oh, gosh, what was his name? I'll think of his name. I don't want to get away from Everett. But Everett, it was his case. Baldwin was his secretary, and so we lost that case 4-3. So then we decided if you can't do it by statute, maybe we can get a constitutional amendment to solve this broad form deed problem. And so, again, our friend over in Pike County, we introduced it and got the constitutional amendment that said that the same language as a statute, a Kentucky constitutional amendment, which was in the ballot in 1988, along with the lottery, with the constitutional amendment to approve the the lottery won by 52%, very close. The constitutional amendment won by 82% of the vote. And so we had a constitutional amendment that said this is how these deeds are going to be interpreted. So then the coal industry decided they're going to challenge that. under what they called the takings clause, their argument was, well, this law has been in, this broad form deed thing has been in effect in Kentucky for the last 50 years. There was a case in 1956 which called Buchanan versus Watson, which was the case that kept being cited over and over and over, where the courts had said the mineral estate is paramount, the surface owner. As long the case had said, unless the mining is arbitrary or wanton or terrible, you know, evil, it is evil, but unless it's just, this is going to, the surface owner can't stop this strip mining. Actually, at one point they had said, the court said, you can get damages. But then they changed their mind. You can't get, couldn't get damages unless it was arbitrary, willful, and wanton. You had to show something other than just the right to mine. So we got this constitutional amendment, and we'd had this case over in Johnson County, an interesting case, where a woman named Garnet Ward, in a little area called Boone's Camp, there hadn't been any mining. This company decided to apply for a permit on her property. And she said, this is my land, and actually I own the minerals, and you can't have them. So they tried to get an injunction against her from interfering with their permit. So we represented Garnet, and it was interesting because the records in the Johnson County Courthouse had some depositions from when this property was first sold. The minerals were sold back around 1800 to, there was a company in New York that had bought up these minerals. And when they bought them, the fellow who lived there at the time, I can't remember that man's name, but it'll come to me, he said, I will let you mine this area, I will give you, sell you the minerals, but on this property, all timber over 12 inches is gonna, you got to leave all the timber over 12 inches in diameter. Well, how can you strip mine property that has that kind of provision in it? So that was in the, so what happened was, after they did this, the people who bought the minerals from him didn't pay him. So he filed a lawsuit to get that money. And in that case, there was a deposition, his deposition, in which he said again, I mean what I said in that deed about leaving these trees. It actually says walnut and chestnut trees back in about, I think, the late 1800s or 1900s. So when we went to court to stop mining on this property, the circuit judge in Johnson County said, yep, that's what this provision says. You can't strip mine this land. You can deep mine, but you can't strip mine. So they appealed to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals said, oh, that's bogus. It's just a broad form deed. That provision doesn't mean what it says. So then we went to the Supreme Court, and while this thing was going on, the constitutional amendment had passed. And by that time, the lawyer who had handled the case had left the office. He was here. And so I took the case up to the Supreme Court. And so I argued the constitutional amendment and said, I told him about this provision. We talked about this provision some, but by and large, we said on the constitutional amendment, they were saying, well, the law had passed. I said, look, they never had the right from the first day when you talked about spirit law. They never had the right to take the surface. They only had the right, they never had the right to strip mine from the 1880 forward. All they knew about was deep mining back then. So when they said, when the coal companies say, we have the right, this has been going on for 50 years, year after year, the law is settled. He said, yeah, but the law, that's not what, they never, it was on a fiction. It was what you would call the spirit of the law. wasn't even the spirit of the law. It was the law. They were trying to sell something they didn't have the right to sell. So the Supreme Court said, yep, plaintiffs, Garnett Ward's correct. Constitutional Amendment means what it says. They were also arguing that it was a taking under the Fifth Amendment, under the federal Constitution. That was their other argument, is that you're taking away our right, basically, this interpretation, without compensating us. These coal companies think they own this minerals, and they have the right to mine. And we said, no, they never had the right to mine. So it was a 4-3 decision again. And so the Constitutional Amendment 1988, it probably helped a lot. It means after that, from then on, a surface owner had the right to, they no longer had the right to strip mine without the surface owner's consent. But I always felt bad about it because just it took so long. It was like 1988. I mean, 88's not 88. Where are we today? It'll soon be, it's 28 years, and they're still trying to buy up stuff. It took, you know, took a long time. But we stayed with it. In the meantime, we helped. And that, and the Constitutional Amendment really put our grassroots group, this Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, which is sort of like the Conservancy in West Virginia and others, it's become a big, it's KFTC. It started, we had a little office downstairs. They have about 10,000 members in Kentucky now. It's gotten to be a big social justice group, still working on mining issues as a grassroots group on some of these things, water quality. It was a year-long campaign called Save the Home Place. T-shirts, they got money, had good advertisements during the halftime of the UK football games. We had a chapter here. Well, we started that in 1981, not really around the broad form deed. We started in 81. It was called the Kentucky Fair Tax Coalition. And it was organized really to try to get a tax on coal in the ground. The coal, and I don't know about West Virginia, but in Kentucky, the people who owned these minerals weren't paying anything, or they're paying a tenth of a cent. So we started this group, a bunch of us got together in Hazard and started talking about how to get a tax on coal, because it would really benefit the school districts. Property taxes are a big source of revenue for schools and for the local health department and whatnot, and they weren't, and a lot of the wealth was untaxed, was under the ground. So that, and then the broad form deed became the other plank. Now the tax, eventually the courts agreed, because Kentucky's constitution says all property shall be taxed at fair cash value. And this was property, we said. So this was Fair Tax Coalition started growing a little bit primarily in the mountains. And so they really worked hard on the broad form deed. And so we got that amendment through. And somewhere about that same time, the court eventually said they had to pay minerals. The Southern Poverty Law Center helped us. In 1981, there was a land study, I don't know if by a group, it wasn't the Council of Southern Mountains, it was partly KFTC, that sponsored this land study. It was sort of who owns the minerals. And it was a study that showed how much of these minerals were owned by out-of-state corporations who weren't paying anything at all to Kentucky. And that was the basis of eventually some litigation. And we had the severance tax came in 1972. Kentucky didn't even have a severance tax. But in 72, it started getting tax, on the severance tax came in. So KFTC came along and really gets the credit for this constitutional amendment. I mean, we did a lot of the legal work, but it was really their grassroots work that led to the very good vote. Although I had often cited the fact the Courier Journal back in the 70s had done a survey of people, and among Kentuckians had done it. I always remember I had this survey about the broad form deed, and 90% of the people who were asked about the broad form deed thought it was wrong to not allow landowner consent. So we did that, and so after that, they changed the name of the group from the Kentucky Fair Tax Coalition to Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, same KFTC, and it continues on. It's got a big staff, it's done really well as a grassroots group working on a lot of social justice, including mining. But then in 19, so we're just talking primarily about coal. The other part of the coal part was really mine safety. I mean, when Apple Red got started with all this mining work with the, and when I started here, obviously Joe Begley, we learned about these coal issues. I mean, this is, and poor people, and the fact that coal wasn't being taxed, and broad form deed. I mean, there were so many things that were wrong. And then we learned, when I came here in 70, was right, first thing that happened almost was the Hyde and Mine disaster. It was November 1970. So I came here, my family, we were still in Washington. We hadn't even moved down yet. It's just I'd agreed to take the job. So I came down and we went to look at somebody we'd been contacted, I think, by eight. I came down and there was, who was a congressman from West Virginia who was Secretary of State for a long time? Remember his name?
Who was Secretary of
State afterwards, but he was... He was congressman from West Virginia at the time of this Hyde and Mine disaster. And he had a hearing. He held a hearing in Hyden, which I went to.
A congressman from West Virginia?
Yeah, he was, I'll think of his name. It was a lovely little guy, Ken Heckler.
Oh, Ken Heckler, of course, yeah.
And he had a committee, and he came down. So we came, we'd been contacted by, the right after that explosion, 38 people were killed in that explosion. And one of them, the one who survived, was a guy named A.T. Collins. And he contacted one of our lawyers in Barberville. So I came down, and we went and started looking at the records, and went to the hearing in Hyden and met Heckler. And, as it turned out, they were using Primacord, an illegal explosive that they had been cited for before. And they had had a bunch of other violations in that
mine. What company was it?
The name of the group, what was it? There were three brothers.
Sturgill?
No. What did I say? It was the Hyden Mine disaster. What was the name of that? I've got it. We'll find it. But it was a family operation, and they had been cited before, and the state could have stopped them beforehand. And they eventually they didn't spend any jail time. They eventually pleaded nolo contendere, and they paid a fine, $150,000. Or something, but they never, I mean, it was an awful, they just whitewashed it. But, it was my first experience in seeing that the agencies were not doing what they should. I mean, they were paying these inspectors not much money, but they'd inspected this mine. They could have shut the mine down and stopped it. And of course, if you've talked to Tony, that's the story we've had year after year. But so I learned that this was going to be an area we need. I mean, a lot of these were coal miners, and if they complained, they get fired if they complain about a safety situation. So I guess it was around 78 or 9 that Tony Opegard came to work for me in Hazard. He came here. I don't know if you got into that, but he came out of law school and came to work for me, and then over a couple of years, he became directing attorney in Hazard. He wasn't doing just mine safety work. He was doing, by that time, well, one of the things I learned was after our environmental stuff, once we got started as a law office for poor people, it's not just mining. You know, you have consumer problems, and you have welfare issues, and you have family law, which is a killer because just everybody, you got divorce, custody, and so we really saw that we needed more people, and at that time, legal services, we only had a few people, and we tried to do some of this other work as well, but so Tony came to our Hazard office out of law school, and he did a lot of, I had three lawyers over there. In 1974, when we first came, and I went to work for Paul in 1972 and 3, the Nixon administration had this guy, Howard Phillips. We'd been filing all these cases, and they called them law reform cases. And then the opponents of legal services programs didn't want us to do that sort of work. They didn't want, out in California, where Governor Reagan, became governor, you had California Rural representing migrant farm workers and Reagan wanted to defund them. And so it was the same, they wanted this outfit, this fellow Howard Phillips wanted to defund and get rid of programs that were doing fairly significant work for poor people other than the divorces. So we got into that problem here in West Virginia and Kentucky. Arch Moore was your governor. What had happened, the reason Paul got a little money in the first place, I guess I didn't tell this story, but the way the thing got started is that at that time, the OEO grants to the community action agencies had to have gubernatorial approval. My friend Terry Linsner knew we weren't going to get approved to get these, that Arch Moore wasn't going to approve Applered. There was an exception in the Office of Economic Opportunity Act for educational grants. So he made this initial grant to the West Virginia Technical Institute as an educational grant and got them under the grant to give the money to Applered as a delegate agreement, which lasted for about 2 years. There was a guy named Jack Robertson on the faculty of West Virginia Technical Institute, who became the chair, but the money went to Applered.
So does that mean they sold Applered as an educational program?
No,
or they just outright?
They just said this is a grant to the West Virginia Technical Institute, and Applered had that educational component. That was what Milton was doing. I mean, it was basically organized.
Milton.
I must have hit something. Did you hear that? Let me turn my thing off. I've got a Bluetooth hearing aid. So after a couple of years, they decided Howard Phillips, somehow when this went on through the West Virginia Technical Institute, the state and the feds realized what was happening, and they decided first it was at a point where Phillips didn't want this law reform work. I mean, Kaufman was doing the same thing in Charleston. He was very interested in energy work and policy work. And so they were doing some major litigation of their own in West Virginia. So they threatened to defund the program. So we got a lawyer, my former boss, Steve Pollack, who had been Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division. I don't know what happened in West Virginia. The long and short of it was that we severed the formal connection between Applewright in West Virginia and Kentucky. And in Kentucky, we created a new corporation, which our governor was sympathetic to at that time, was Ford, and called it Appalachian Research and Defense Fund of Kentucky. We didn't want to confuse people, so we stayed with Applewright. In West Virginia, they had a more difficult time with Arch Moore, and they started a new Judicare program, which got most of their money. Judicare is when legal services contracts are contracted out to private attorneys to do divorces and individual cases. And Applewright managed to stay alive, but they cut their funding by several hundred thousand dollars. So from then on, there was no more of a formal connection between the two programs. We still knew who we were. I mean,
say that again, please.
I mean,
we still knew who we were.
Well, I mean, we knew. I'm sorry. There was communication, but we started from scratch. And basically, Applewright in Kentucky is as it is today, from 1973 forward. I became the director at that point here, and in West Virginia, they kept going. You know, Paul and his wife had that awful automobile accident shortly afterwards, and eventually Milton became the director. Milton, at that point, had been the director of their sort of educational component, and he kept getting a little money from the New World Fund, from these New World and a couple of the other foundations. And he was funded Eula Hall and Nick Frazier, who was an organizer on Mud Creek. And they worked out of my office here across the street. Then Eula and I went, there was still that little connection to Milton in West Virginia because they were actually his employees and they were working out of my office. And so we maintained some communication. But then we grew. In 1974, the Legal Services Corporation was created by Congress. It was one of the last bills that Nixon signed, that Nixon approved the creation of the Legal Services Corporation. It's another different story. It went along. Gerald Ford had vetoed it, and Nixon had, I think, vetoed it a while because it was, so anyway, it was a nonprofit corporation at the national level that would be funding programs like Applewright across the country to do legal services work.
For the poor.
For the poor, in whatever the civil needs for the poor were. And so in 1974, the budget was around $75 million nationally. It was very limited. Most of the early legal services programs were in the Northeast or in California where the bar had been supportive. Like when I came here in 1972 to set up the program, the local bar was, they still were thinking about Vistas. You know, they'd had a fight with the school over food stamps here. I mean, everybody, there was a lot of head knock going back and forth. Vista came here and ended up in Bristol, Virginia. Remember when Milton and, I think Milton was in Prestonsburg for a little while, and the AVs ended up going back to, went to Bristol. But at one point, they had an office here in Prestonsburg. Anyway.
Well, there were many local sort of offices. I mean, I had a four-county area that I worked. Flem Messer over here had
Clay County.
Well, he was from Clay County.
Yeah.
And his dad was a great guy. But I don't know. Did Milton actually live in Prestonsburg?
Well, I think he might have been here. I don't know. He was here for a short time. Maybe he didn't. I just remember, I think maybe that was the kind of office you were talking about. I mean, I knew Flem Messer later in Clay County.
Yeah.
But I...
Well, he was over here in the mid-60s.
But the bar here was very hostile when we first started, because they thought we wanted, the Mountain People's Rights had been here, and we were going to sue coal companies, and, you know, they didn't want out, they'd had their fill of outsiders. I mean, you've heard that before, over and over. They were, and so they were, well, they passed. I asked them at one point, I said, one of my friends was one of these local lawyers, was the president of the bar, and I said, we need to set up a fair system so that if people come in here who are not eligible financially for our services, we can send them to the local lawyers by some sign-up list or some alphabetical list, just give them, find a fair system to do that, so you won't think we're just favoring a particular lawyer. And he said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. I'll call a bar meeting and see if I can help you. So he got a bar meeting. He said, well, and the resolution they passed, instead of doing that, they passed a resolution that they didn't need us here, that they really, that we shouldn't be here unless we had their approval, and they weren't going to give us their approval. So they were, the Bar Association was not supportive. Over the years, they've become very supportive. But it was not an easy place to get started, as it was the case in many rural areas. The lawyers thought we were going to take away their business. Well, obviously, we represent poor people who couldn't pay them anyway. So later on, I always tell the story, I remember that same lawyer years a couple of years later, it was Christmas time, just about Christmas. I saw him on the street, and he said, John, you haven't sued any of my clients lately. It's getting to be Christmas. You need to sue my clients so that I can get some, make some money. So that's the other side of the coin. If I sue a coal company, they're going to get him. So
they're going to hire him to defend them.
Yeah. But... So it was, that's, and then over the years, Applewood and West Virginia became part of that statewide program. They're not there anymore. You have the West Virginia Justice Center, the group that Dan Hedges has over there. But so we, from that, from 1974, the budget was about $74 million. Between 1974 and 1980, the budget went from $74 million to about $320 million for legal services nationally. So from 1974, all of a sudden, those were the really nice heyday. We opened up 10 offices in eastern Kentucky, this program. We had offices in Hazard and Harlan. That's how Tony ended up being in Hazard. And so we got started on a lot of this mine safety work that he became such a wonderful expert in. And we can leave it at that for now. Yeah, we just